Hello, and welcome back to One Quarter English. I'm Jenna.
And I'm Mark. Thanks for tuning in. Over the next quarter of an hour, we'll present the latest news headlines from around the world before discussing one of the topics in greater detail. We'll then look at some spelling differences between American and British English. After that, you'll find out how to choose between the articles and. You'll hear the second installment of a classic Sherlock Holmes story, and then we'll end the podcast with something fun. Enjoy the show.
In a landmark decision, the government of Calantria has announced sweeping reforms to its death penalty laws. Effective immediately, the death penalty will be abolished for all crimes except for acts of terrorism and treason. Human rights groups have hailed this decision as a significant step forward, while some political factions argue that it might compromise national security.
In other news, after months of diplomatic standoffs and border skirmishes between Zindora and Nuvoria, tensions have escalated into full-blown war following an alleged cyber attack that crippled Zindora's national power grid. Analysts fear this conflict could destabilize the entire region if not contained swiftly.
Meanwhile, the coastal city of Rivertown is grappling with severe flooding after unprecedented rainfall over the past 72 hours. Rivers have burst their banks, inundating homes and businesses and forcing thousands to evacuate. Authorities are urging residents to move to higher ground and heed evacuation orders as more rain is forecast in the coming days.
A surprising new scientific study from the University of Nordheim has revealed that daily consumption of dark chocolate may lead to increased brain activity in areas associated with learning and memory.
And now for some light-hearted news. Guinness World Records has just recognized a new achievement. Max, a border collie from Treton, has set the record for the most socks collected by a dog in 1 minute. Max managed to gather a staggering 47 socks in just 60 seconds, delighting his owners and earning him a place in the record books. Max's owner, Linda, says he has always had a peculiar love for socks, and now it seems his quirky habit has paid off. Okay, Mark. In the US, 27 states still use the death penalty as a legal punishment, and I'd like to hear your opinion on it.
I'm from a state that has capital punishment, Jenna. So I grew up believing that the death penalty serves several important functions in our justice system. For one, it acts as a deterrent to serious crimes. Knowing they could face the ultimate punishment can dissuade potential criminals from committing heinous acts.
Are you really sure about that? Studies show that countries and states without the death penalty often have lower murder rates. This suggests that other factors, such as economic conditions, education, and policing strategies, play a far more critical role in crime prevention.
I'll give you that one, Jenna. But what about the sense of justice and closure the death penalty gives to victims' families? If someone commits a brutal murder, it seems fitting that the punishment reflects the severity of the crime.
I understand the desire for justice and closure, but I firmly believe that taking a life as punishment is inherently wrong. It is a violation of human rights and an act of state-sanctioned violence. Plus, the death penalty is irreversible, and there have been numerous cases where individuals on death row were later found to be innocent through new evidence or DNA testing.
Okay, I agree with your last point, Jenna, but wouldn't you agree that the safety and security of society are paramount? The death penalty ensures that the most dangerous criminals are permanently removed from society.
Yes, it does. But a life sentence without parole can also serve as a severe punishment that protects society without taking a life.
I guess we just have different definitions of what constitutes severe punishment. Inmates serving life sentences often have access to various luxuries, such as television, educational programs, and recreational activities. They get served 3 meals a day and have a bed to sleep in and a roof overhead. A lot of people who have never committed a crime, let alone murdered someone, don't have those basic needs met.
Yes, Mark, but that's not a problem of the criminal justice system. And while I agree that watching television and having access to educational programs are luxuries, prisoners should be entitled to have their basic needs met. Otherwise, we run the risk of violating human rights.
Do you think inmates should be allowed to vote?
That's a whole other kettle of fish, Mark. But no, I don't think they should be allowed to vote.
Finally, something we can agree on.
Okay, Mark, This episode, I'd like to take a look at how American and British English differ in terms of spelling.
Sure, Jenna. Where should we start?
I guess we'll begin with the ones that everyone knows. I think the most well-known difference is in words like colour or favourite.
Right. British English spells them with O-U, but American English spells them with an O. What about words like centre or metre, Jenna?
Easy. Brits spell them with R-E at the end, but Americans spell them with E-R, right?
Exactly. And how do you spell organize?
O-R-G-A-N-I-S-E. What about you?
With a Z, not an S. And the same goes for realize and analyze and other words ending in I-Z-E or Y-Z-E.
What about the word program? Does it have two M's and an E on the end?
Nope, just one M. We also spell catalog without the U and E on the end.
And do you double the L in words like cancelled or travelled?
Nope, just one L. But we spell enroll and enrollment with two L's.
Interesting. In British English, it only has one L. Can you think of any other differences?
One more. How do you spell defense?
D-E-F-E-N-C-E. You don't?
Americans spell it with an S instead of a C. And the others?
Oh, tire with a Y and grey with an E.
Really? I spell it T-I-R-E and G-R-A-Y. Wait, I just thought of another one. And this one really bothers me. How do you spell encyclopedia?
E-N-C-Y-C-L-O-P-A-E-D-I-A.
American English doesn't use the A-E or O-E spellings of words like encyclopedia or maneuver. We just use an E.
Do you know why the differences exist?
Yeah, I do. One of the most significant influences on American English spelling was Noah Webster, an American lexicographer who published an American Dictionary of the English Language in 1828. Webster advocated for spelling reforms to make American English more logical and phonetic. He simplified many British spellings, and these changes were widely adopted in the United States.
So if you're not sure which is the American English and which is the British English spelling, the simpler and more phonetic spelling is American English most of the time. But both are perfectly acceptable. Just remember to be consistent.
Except if you're Canadian.
Canadian? What do you mean, Mark?
How about I let my Canadian friend, Steve, explain? He's a journalist and has to follow spelling guidelines set by the Canadian press. All right, Steve, the floor is yours.
Okay, I'm going to list a bunch of words and tell you whether each is spelled the American or British way in Canadian English. Ready? Color, British. Theater, British. Organize, American. Program, American. Analog, British. Traveling, British. Enroll, British. Defense, British. Tire, American. Encyclopedia, British. Gray, British. And dreamed, American.
Dreamed? What's the British way?
Dreamt with a T.
So what's the tally for Canadian English?
8 British and 4 American spellings.
Not very consistent, right? So for most English learners, it's probably easier to follow American or British spelling rules. In this episode, I'd like to focus on a particular grammar mistake that drives me nuts. And even the most advanced English learners get this wrong. I'm going to say a bunch of words, and I want you to tell me if you put a or an in front of them.
Okay, I'm ready.
Here we go. Mouse.
A mouse.
Classroom.
A classroom.
Subsidy.
A subsidy.
Antidote.
An antidote.
Odyssey.
An odyssey.
Good. So you know the grammar point I want to review today, right?
Definitely. Ah goes before a consonant and an goes before a vowel.
That's how it's usually taught, but that's not quite right.
It isn't?
No. Try these words. Octopus.
An octopus.
One.
A one.
Umbrella.
An umbrella.
University.
A university.
Utopia.
A utopia.
Understanding.
An understanding. Aha. I see what you're getting at, Mark. It's not the letter that's important, it's the sound. Because some vowels can actually sound like consonants, like in university or one.
Exactly. And some consonants at the start of a word are silent, so you only hear the following vowel.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. Honor. It was an honor to meet you.
I think it's also important to point out that the ah or an always agrees with the sound of the first letter of the word directly after it, regardless of whether that word is a noun, an adjective, or an adverb.
Can you give me an example?
Well, you say an incredible movie or a thoughtful answer.
Good point, Jenna. A lot of learners make the mistake of thinking the article has to agree with a noun. Acronyms can be tricky too. What's the article for these words? VIP.
A VIP.
CCTV camera.
A CCTV camera.
UN mission.
a UN mission.
ICU patient.
An ICU patient.
MP3 file.
An MP3 file.
Good. So in acronyms, it's the sound of the first letter, not what the letter actually is. That's important. If it sounds like a vowel, use an. If it sounds like a consonant, use a.
Okay, Mark, it's crystal clear now. Using a or an is a piece of cake, not an impossible task.
It's that time again. Are you ready for the second installment of the Speckled Band, Jenna?
Go for it, Mark. I'm all ears.
Alas, the very horror of my situation lies in the fact that my fears are so vague and my suspicions depend so entirely upon small points, which might seem trivial to another, that even he to whom of all others I have a right to look for help and advice looks upon all that I tell him about it as the fancies of a nervous woman. He does not say so, but I can read it from his soothing answers and averted eyes. But I have heard, Mr. Holmes, that you can see deeply into the manifold wickedness of the human heart. You may advise me how to walk amid the dangers which encompass me.
I am all attention, madam.
My name is Helen Stoner, and I am living with my stepfather, who is the last survivor of one of the oldest Saxon families in England, the Roylotts of Stoke Moran, on the western border of Surrey.
Holmes nodded his head.
The name is familiar to me.
The family was at one time among the richest in England, and the estates extended over the borders into Berkshire in the north and Hampshire in the west. In the last century, however, four successive heirs were of a dissolute and wasteful disposition, and the family ruin was eventually completed by a gambler in the days of the Regency. Nothing was left save a few acres of ground and the 200-year-old house, which is itself crushed under a heavy mortgage. The last squire dragged out his existence there, living the horrible life of an aristocratic pauper, but his only son, my stepfather, seeing that he must adapt himself to the new conditions, obtained an advance from a relative, which enabled him to take a medical degree, and went out to Calcutta, where, by his professional skill and his force of character, he established a large practice. In a fit of anger, however, caused by some robberies which had been perpetrated in the house, he beat his native butler to death and narrowly escaped a capital sentence. As it was, he suffered a long term of imprisonment and afterwards returned to England a morose and disappointed man. When Dr. Roylott was in India, he married my mother, Mrs. Stoner, the young widow of Major General Stoner of the Bengal Artillery. My sister Julia and I were twins, and we were only 2 years old at the time of my mother's remarriage. She had a considerable sum of money, not less than £1,000 a year, and this she bequeathed to Dr. Roylott entirely while we resided with him, with a provision that a certain annual sum should be allowed to each of us in the event of our marriage. Shortly after our return to England, my mother died. She was killed 8 years ago in a railway accident near Crewe. Dr. Roylott then abandoned his attempts to establish himself in practice in London and took us to live with him in the old ancestral house at Stoke Moran. The money which my mother had left was enough for all our wants, and there seemed to be no obstacle to our happiness. But a terrible change came over our stepfather about this time. Instead of making friends and exchanging visits with our neighbours, who had at first been overjoyed to see a Roylott of Stoke Moran back in the old family seat, he shut himself up in his house and seldom came out save to indulge in ferocious quarrels with whoever might cross his path. Violence of temper approaching to mania has been hereditary in the men of the family, and in my stepfather's case it had, I believe, been intensified by his long residence in the tropics. A series of disgraceful brawls took place, two of which ended in the police court, until at last he became the terror of the village and the folks would fly at his approach, for he is a man of immense strength and absolutely uncontrollable in his anger. Last week he hurled the local blacksmith over a parapet into a stream, and it was only by paying over all the money which I could gather together that I was able to avert another public exposure. He had no friends at all save the wandering gypsies, and he would give these vagabonds leave to encamp upon the few acres of bramble-covered land which represent the family estate, and would accept in return the hospitality of their tents, wandering away with them sometimes for weeks on end. He has a passion also for Indian animals, which are sent over to him by a correspondent, and he has at this moment a cheetah and a baboon, which wander freely over his grounds and are feared by the villagers almost as much as their master. You can imagine from what I say that my poor sister Julia and I had no great pleasure in our lives. No servant would stay with us, and for a long time we did all the work of the house. She was but 30 at the time of her death, and yet her hair had already begun to whiten, even as mine has.
Your sister is dead, then?
She died just 2 years ago, and it is of her death that I wish to speak to you.
And that's it for this installment of The Speckled Band. Next time, we'll find out about the mysterious death of Helen Stoner's sister. And maybe I'll finally get my promised cameo. Right, Jenna?
Remember that patience is a virtue, Mark. Anyway, it's time to move on to something fun. I've got a riddle here that needs answering. Let's see who can solve it first. Mark or Steve, are you two ready?
I'm ready.
I'm good to go, Jenna.
All right, then. Here's the riddle. I'm not alive, but I grow. I don't have lungs, but I need air. I don't have a mouth, but water kills me. What am I?
A tree? No, that wasn't my guess. Water definitely doesn't kill a tree.
Too late. You spoke too soon. What about a balloon?
A balloon? You can't kill a balloon, Steve. Damage. Yes, but not kill.
Any other ideas?
Grows, needs air, doesn't like water. Ha, I've got it. It's fire.
Good job, Mark.
Yeah, nice work.
Well, that's it for this episode. We hope you enjoyed it.
Tune in next time for more headlines, more in-depth discussions, another difference between British and American English, a grammar point explained, and more Sherlock Holmes. Plus, there'll be something fun at the end. Bye for now.
Until next time.